Chances are, you've heard the term climate change, a buzzword for some persons, perhaps. Now, why should I care? Some of you might ask. Chances are, we've been contributing to its effects by way of pollution, the burning of fossil fuels, or garbage disposal, deforestation, the cutting down of trees without replanting. Chances are, we've also witnessed rising sea levels. This, my fellow Jamaicans, know all too well. The erosion of our infamous Helsher Beach, what it was then and what it is now. Chances are, we've experienced dramatic changes in weather conditions. Chances are, you're feeling the heat in temperature rises. Climate change manifests itself in a myriad of ways and is experienced by each and every one of us, witnessing the transformation of our entire global ecosystem. On this week's episode of Impact 360.
The Global South are the countries that I believe, to put it in a nutshell, are struggling the most mm-hmm. with the effects of climate change. But mm-hmm. the Global North, I think, in my opinion, is only really starting to feel things. Whereas for the Global South, all of this has been happening for decades and decades. And the Global North have become accustomed to the occasional news items about terrible flooding in Bangladesh or drought mm-hmm. in Ethiopia. And it's like, oh yeah, you know, that those things happen in those countries. But we're okay.
Welcome to Impact 360. A program that informs, educates, and builds awareness of shared experiences on issues that affect human conditions. We'll be connecting with individuals and organizations that operate meaningful, sustainable programs positively affecting people's lives. We hope that this helps to create a paradigm shift for us to live harmoniously with each other. Kindness and compassion, as we all know, go a long way. So join the movement that celebrates improving lives, improving communities. According to the UN, United Nations, we have only but 11 years left to prevent irreversible damage from climate change. But don't be too alarmed, though. We can all be mindful and contribute in various ways to help mitigate those damages and bolster climate resilience through risk management to be able to coexist with natural hazards. Let's begin with our adult selves and encourage our kids in the process. With that being said, we will engage Alan Hesse, a conservation biologist, in dialogue about climate change and its impacts on our human existence. Buenas tardes, Alan. Bienvenido a Impact 360.
Muchas gracias. Thank you very much, Clandine. It's a pleasure to be here. I have been looking forward to this.
Bueno. Preséntate a la audiencia.
In English. Yes.
Absolutamente.
Well, okay. Yeah, my name is Alan James Hesse, and I am a conservation biologist with 30 years of experience in conservation in Latin America, ranging from the southern areas of South America to Mexico. During that time, I've really become familiar with not only conservation in the field, conservation in practice, but also the reality of the Global South. I myself consider myself more of a citizen of the Global South than of the North, because although I'm British and French by nationality and have lived in Europe, I have mostly lived in the Global South and was born in Asia and have lived for the past 30 years in Latin America. And so I'm very, very sensitive to the realities in developing countries And in parallel to my conservation work, I'm also an author illustrator of graphic novels for middle grade children and all about the natural environment and climate change particularly. So I have a series of four graphic novels called The Adventures of Captain Polo, and that is all about climate change. It's educational comics, so it's fiction, but based on geographical settings that are accurate and, of course, heavily researched science to make sure that all those messages are in there and they're accurate. And so I'm very excited about that, about the author journey. And it's kind of taking over the rest of it, actually. And so I'm very pleased to be here, Glendine, and discuss all this further.
Awesome. You're pretty much utilizing a particular tool to bring awareness to kids, a tool that is not normally used in the school system, so to speak. That's a very interesting approach, and I'm sure we're going to delve into it a little bit more as we proceed.
Yes, that would be great.
Let's start off with the fact that today is the 4th of November, 2021, and it marks the fifth day of the UN's Climate Change Conference, COP26.
Yep.
How do you believe discussions around climate change will in fact influence a change in mindsets and behaviors from people around the globe?
Well, it's a great question, and it is very timely that we're doing this today, because the COP is in full swing, and this is considered one of all the many, many COPs, of all the 26 COPs that have happened, this is considered, along with the Paris one of 2015, probably a pivotal moment in history. This COP26 is considered as important, if not more so, than the Paris one in 2015. And the reason is that we really do not have time as a global society to fiddle anymore. To answer your question, Glendine, the talks going on, it's only day five, so it's difficult to say, but I'm keeping my eye on all the news coming through. And there's mixed news, as always. There's on the surface, things are looking positive. There's a lot of pledging going on. I think 40 countries have pledged to phase out coal completely. Mm-hmm. I think the Global North coalition countries are all on the same page in terms of $100 billion for financial aid. But that, again, is contested by other parties, where saying that it's all talk but no action. But at the same time, my personal opinion is, let's let them talk for now. I mean, they are at the COP. That's what you do at the COP. You do talk.
We talk.
So exactly. Talk, you know, get on with it. Just talk. But mm-hmm. let that talk be reflected in legally binding documents and pledges that are, above all, transparent to the public.
Very
the
much
public.
So. Mm-hmm.
It has to be transparent. It has to be, they have to be accountable for what goes on in that blue zone, you know. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think, you know, the big difference, Glendine, this year, though, is that there's never been so much involvement by global society. Mm. You know, artists, students, youth groups, people like you and me, you know, we're always being excluded from these dialogues of the COP. And thanks to the efforts of individuals like Greta Thunberg and other youth activists all over the world, mm-hmm. This is changing, and the civil society around the world has never had a stronger voice, I believe, than it has today. So that is bound to work in our favor, you know, and sway political will, I would imagine, more than it ever has done before. So I'm optimistic, but of course, time will tell. Actions have to be implemented. It's too early to say, really, with regard to COP26. But let's keep our fingers crossed.
Yeah, it's pretty important to have actual environmental scientists, civil society, and key community stakeholders at the table to have conversations, to be involved in the dialogue taking place, and to help to provide solutions to those who are being, impacted or directly impacted, especially for those who are being directly impacted. Speaking of which, you know, you mentioned the Global South earlier, and we are quite aware that majority of the emissions are really radiating from the global north, from those bigger countries. Explain to us, what is the global south and what is the global north? And can you give a little bit of example in terms of how the different spheres are being affected?
Yeah, it's a big question. I mean, I'm not an expert on this by any means, don't get me wrong. I'm not a development worker, but I do know, I believe the global south, I mean, I don't think it's a geographical reference so much as a geopolitical reference. It's not, you know, Australia, for example, is in the southern hemisphere, but I don't consider it to be part of the global south. The global south are the countries that I believe, to put it in a nutshell, are struggling the most with the effects of climate change, which I guess what really differentiates the global south from the north in terms of climate is that in the north, climate change is only very recently starting to be felt in people's daily lives and in very specific and isolated events, like the Germans suffering the incredibly terrible flooding that they did earlier this year that made world news. You know, that's very unusual and isolated event. And the global north is all up in arms about it.
Australia as well.
And Australia with, of course, the fires and the floods. The United States with, again, the fires and the floods, you know, the effects of all the ocean events like hurricanes on the United States, of course, are devastating every year and getting worse because as surface waters warm up, it affects the ocean climate systems. And in fact, these hurricanes are becoming more frequent as a result of that. But the global north, I think, in my opinion, is only really starting to feel things. Whereas for the global south, all of this has been happening for decades and decades. And they've just, the global north have become accustomed to the occasional news items about terrible flooding in Bangladesh or drought in Ethiopia. And it's like, oh yeah, you know, that those things happen in those countries. But we're okay, right? That's basically the difference. Whereas the global south has, by virtue of so many factors, been suffering the effects of a changing climate for decades.
And the global south, we would say, are the small island developing states, right?
Yeah, they're definitely included. All the least developed
developing countries.
The LDCs, the least developed nations, you know, basically all the countries that are still struggling in terms of development. They are all
socioeconomic development.
Socioeconomic development, and you know there are big things like the global south. You know, the climate change exacerbates other endemic issues of the global south, such as social inequality, poverty, access, lack of access to basic resources, education for girls. You know, the effects of deforestation, landslides, soil erosion, prolonged droughts and floods. All this happens all the time in the global south. And climate change makes it all worse, basically. And so the global north has the luxury of being better equipped to deal with things like this when they do happen. And, you know, and I also think in the north, the onus is mostly everything about mitigation of climate change, quite rightly. And in the south,
and adaptation.
Well, it should be more about adaptation.
Adaptation.
It is starting to happen. But in the south,
the problem, the horse has already gone through the gates.
Yes.
So
in the south, the emphasis is always being reacting, on adaptation, you know. Let's deal with what is already happening. But in fact, as a global society, we need to have the north and south think of both mitigation and adaptation. And that is starting to happen. I think it is. There's a lot of solutions coming out of the global south. This is something I like to always talk about. There's a lot of solutions, innovation. In my experience, the global south societies tend to innovate very quickly because they have to. There's no one going to do it for them. So they have to. And so that's also a big difference, I think.
I suppose intervention comes in. Intervention in early childhood education, which is a very critical component to approach adaptation needs. It needs to be systemic, right? Teaching kids from an early age, the importance on environmental sustainability, which is where you come into play, right?
Right.
You bring awareness, as mentioned before, through your tool of learning via comic illustrations.
Yeah.
Tell us about that. Tell us a little bit more in terms of how you go about demonstrating the effects, the impacts of climate change to kids. How do you pass on this message via Polo, Captain Polo, the adventures of Captain Polo?
Yeah, that's right. Captain Polo. It all starts with the premise that with children, you don't want to sugarcoat reality.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe in hiding reality from children. That even at the youngest of ages, they deserve to know what's going on. That doesn't mean we have to traumatize them.
Right.
It's all about how you do it, right? So children need to know the facts. But above all, and this isn't me saying this, this is based on surveys, you know, run with schools all over the world. Kids in class or kids at home, they want to know the solution. They get the facts very quickly because kids are smart. And then they want to know, what can I do? and so the idea is to give them that knowledge, to empower them, to feel part of the solution. And let's not forget, they are the future generation that are going to make decisions.
Absolutely. Inheriting our mess, basically.
They're inheriting our mess. And if we don't watch out, they'll make more mess. So we need to make sure they don't make the same mess that past generations have made.
Absolutely.
And I'm pretty confident that's not going to happen because I'm very optimistic about education, generally from what I'm seeing. But the way of using graphic novels is really my way of bringing in entertainment and mixing entertainment with nonfiction and combining fiction and nonfiction. Because what I want is I want kids, or indeed anybody, to pick up my books and have a really good read. I want them to love the books. I want them to fall in love with my characters. And I want Captain Polo to be a household name like Paddington Bear or like Winnie the Pooh. Why not? With the added bonus that Polo has a message about sustainability and about climate and all this. And so the idea is to mix entertainment with education, edutainment, a growing term right now. If you have fun while you're learning something, you're more likely to remember what it says. And I believe a lot in the involving the emotions. We all take decisions based on emotions, humans. We're very emotional beings. And so it's important to harness those emotions. And that's the power of storytelling. It's the power of fiction. It's the power of making you travel, journey your mind. So my books are full of geographical locations, which are very carefully researched based on my own experience firsthand, but also on Google Maps, which is very useful. Google Earth as well, I use to get just the right angle on those mountains and, all this. And when you bring in the mix of a good, fun, fast-paced story with very carefully researched fact, with a lot of cultural diversity and geographical diversity in the mix, all of which is very accurate, I hope you come up with a compelling read. One that will drive the message home, but not in your face, rather in a subtle way where you kind of pick up on the messages and identify with the characters and identify with the geographical settings. My books are mainly aimed at kids from the global north because I think that's where the priority is. I think kids from the global north need to understand that the decisions they make and what they consume or what they ask their parents to consume will have knock-on effects in the global south and in the global north as well, It's important for kids to make that connection between what they do in the UK may affect someone in Nepal, because we're all part of one global society. And with globalization and, all the stuff coming out of China, all the goods and products, it's all it's all connected, isn't it?
It's all interrelated, for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm looking behind you, Alan.
Yes,
and
good.
I think I spot Captain Polo. Is that Captain Polo behind you?
That is Captain.
Can we say hi to Captain Polo?
Say hello. Say hello, Captain Polo.
Hello, Captain Polo.
Hola. He says he's shy. He's not shy. He's not used to appearing he says you're very nice. Yeah, likes what you say. And congratulations with the show, he says.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Sorry, I use this version of Polo when I go to do school visits.
Okay, beautiful.
With the younger kids, you know, like 6 years old.
Yes.
They
can relate. They'll relate. It's more relatable.
Yeah, they want to hug him and they ask me questions like, does he like pizza? And does he have a favorite ice cream? And, you know, all this. And it makes it more and more relatable for them.
Absolutely. So Captain Polo's adventures provide a powerful learning tool that raises awareness to children in an engaging way, in a more enjoyable way, as you mentioned before, to start climate literacy.
Yeah.
And you mentioned the fact that it's primarily catered to kids in the north, but then there are also kids in the south who are very much unaware of what climate change entails, how it affects the environment, how human activities affects the environment. You know, I shared with you recently how I did a very informal survey here in Jamaica of kids between the ages of 5 to 11. And I was in shock that, good percentage of those kids that were asked across the island did not have a clue what climate change is. They've never heard the term of climate change. So, you know, I'm excited about the fact that perhaps, you know, as was mentioned, from a systemic level, that we need to indoctrinate the kids from an early age, you know, for them to be aware of how we need to be environmentally conscious, to be mindful of how we relate with each other and how we relate to the environment. So it would be a really good treat if you could partner, I don't know, with the Ministry of Education and to probably do some kind of pilot project to kind of help. But obviously you would have to, I guess you'd have to customize your illustrations and to you know, the focus from north to more south and how our environment is being degraded. And it's not just from the natural elements, you know, but also from man-made disasters. It would be a very good feature to have in our school curriculum here in Jamaica. That's for sure.
There's nothing I would love more. You know, the action in the books is actually located mostly in the Global South, as it happens. I would love to do that. And in fact, that's where I'm headed. I'm trying to establish those kinds of connections.
Mm-hmm.
It's just having the books on Amazon or whatever is not enough. It's not what I'm going for. That's not what
needs to be out there. It needs to be in the hands.
It needs to be in front of the right people. And I totally agree. It needs to be all over the place in the Global South as well. And I'm trying to work on something here where I live in Ecuador along those lines. And it's really all a question about making the right connections.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I were to make a connection with suitable or relevant institutions in Jamaica, for example, I would love that. So if anyone out there is listening, please contact Clandine and myself, and let's get this going. I will totally. That is what I'm headed for. Actually, it's not only about Kids for the Global North. Absolutely not. Absolutely not. The reason I say that is because that's the primary market right now, and then it's more likely to move quicker in the connections I have in the Global North. But that's only because I have more connections there. If I could establish connections in any country and anywhere else, it could go a lot quicker, actually. I'm definitely driving for that. Yeah.
You're a man who seemed to wear many hats, Alan. Conservation yeah. biologist, educator, author, illustrator, born in Pakistan to a French mother and a British father.
Yeah.
You have experienced many countries around the world. India, Oman, Italy, yes. Africa, Europe.
You've done your homework, yeah.
Now you've landed in Ecuador. Yep. South America, where you're based.
Yeah.
So right. based on your travels, how have you yeah. witnessed differences in the global north and the global south being affected by climate change?
Well, it's what I was saying earlier. It's the global south has been on this long, long history of extreme exposure and silently dealing with it. I'm talking about farmers' wives in India. I'm talking about herders in Tanzania. I'm talking about, you know, a smallholder farmers in the Colombian Andes with maybe 5 or 6 cows. You know, I'm talking about the very, 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 the sort of the humblest of people who are on the edge of survival. They've been on the edge of survival for as long as, you know, for forever sort of thing. So climate change has always been part of their life, except they don't label it that way. It wasn't always being labeled, but you know, a farmer or a woman looking for water to fill her pots in India, in rural India, will always be dependent on rainfall. And rainfall now no longer happens when people say it does. You know, Maasai herders in East Africa no longer can rely on annual rains like they did maybe 30 years ago. Because those annual rains may not come. Or if they do come, they don't know when they'll come or how long they'll last. So there's this deep uncertainty, which is a technical term of climate change science. Deep uncertainty is when you don't know what's going to happen or not happen when. The favelas of Rio de Janeiro are prone to terrible landslide problems and water shortage, which is ironic. They have both too much water and not enough water at the same time sometimes. Of course, one is the drinking kind and the other one is what is, you know, what runs in the streets. And so, but there's all this very, very precarious lifestyle which characterizes the global south. Whereas the north, people who have never been out of the global north have no idea. They may see it on TV shows and documentaries, but they have no idea of the day-to-day gut-wrenching reality of it. Mm-hmm. They have no idea. I haven't got a clue. Mm-hmm. It's a much rawer experience in the global south than it is in the global north. You know, as I said at the early part of the podcast, with the exception of these isolated events that are happening, like the floods in Germany this year, which were just crazy, and the heat waves that are affecting European cities, you know, in the summer, causing deaths, in fact. But, you know, I still consider those to be relatively rare and isolated events that draw a lot of attention. Whereas the global south, a tendency is to live these things almost on a daily basis in silence because of so many reasons. And it's almost like the global north, as a member of the global north in terms of my nationalities, I think I'm qualified to say that it's almost like there's an expectation from the global north that these things happen in the global south because it's the global south. and that's just the way it is. Bad luck, so sorry, you know, and you know, let's just get on with it. But yeah. it's kind of it's something that is a very difficult, it's kind of a sensitive subject.
It's a catch-21, because while yeah. we're asking persons to kind of change their behavior, a lot of these behaviors, especially in the South, is as a result of economic deficiencies.
Yeah.
So it's basically for survival. Yeah. And, you know, what do they yeah. do? What do we do?
I've just thought of an example, actually. which I touch upon in book three of my Captain Polo series, is the Syrian war refugees. The Syrian war, Captain Polo meets some Syrian war refugees in the Mediterranean and helps to save one or two of them. And what the theme of that part of the book is, based on research, it turns out that the Arab Spring was really a detonator of, it was a spark that detonated the Arab Spring and then the resulting Syrian civil war. But there was a drought in Syria that few people know about outside Syria. This drought was a 5-year-long drought, and it was devastating to the entire rural population of Syria. And as a result, all the rural population migrated in desperation to the cities along the coast. And then the Arab Spring happened, and it was just a tinderbox. And so a large part of the migration that is coming from the Middle East or North Africa, or even sub-Saharan Africa, is a lot of it is the root cause is related to climate change. It's because, you know, with droughts, your livelihood, if you're a farmer or a herder, and there's a prolonged drought that lasts for 5 or 6 years, you've got no choice. You've got to get out. And then, you know, add to that all the political repressive regimes, which are quite common in that part of the world, and you really got no choice but to get on a rubber boat and try and get to Europe. And so I want European children to understand the bigger picture of this pushback against immigration. I know that immigration is a very difficult subject. It's a very, very sensitive subject, and I'm not pulling one way or the other. That's not
everything these days is very sensitive. It's very sensitive. Is what I notice. But
that's right. You do have to take a stance, though. You do have to take a stance.
Definitely.
And defend it, you know.
And be humane. I mean, we have to, you know, it's, I find that we are losing humanity. The lack of humanity has existed since time immemorial, but it's almost progressing. It's, you know, as opposed to getting better at it, because at the end of the day, we are interconnected and everything that we do is interrelated. So we just have to be not just conscious of the, you know, not just to be conscious of the environment and how we treat it, but, you know, we also need to be conscious of how we treat each other and ourselves in the process. So it's the whole notion of being kind and empathetic to others and, you know, just to realize that the struggles are there, the struggles are real. And a lot of the times, as human beings, we need support from other human beings. So if that means moving to another country, then, you know, so be it. Yeah. Speaking of Notion, I appreciate the fact that your idealism of how you bring awareness to climate change is the fact that you said you don't want to preach to the choir. You don't want to be talking to persons who are already aware. You don't want to be talking to the environmentalists and the scientists and the political representatives, so to speak. So, you know, what are some of the ingredients? And you alluded to that because I'd actually wanted to get into, you know, how do you go about telling these stories? What influences where Captain Polo goes and the type of approach, you know, how is it that you get to generate the information to share it with others? And speaking of which, what would you say to a 6-year-old? How do you tell them what climate change, how do you define climate change to a 6-year-old?
Yeah, it's not easy. It's not easy. But like I said, you can't hide the facts. And you have to, I think, I wrote an article about this recently for a blog. I think you have to make a little, you know, if it's for a 6-year-old, you have to make it into a little story. And it can be a story which has a realistic beginning and dramatic beginning, but it has to have a happy ending so that the child doesn't feel overwhelmed or, you know, blocks out anything. We want the child to be empowered. And for that to happen, it has to, the child needs to feel there's a way out. Bringing it into a little story where you talk about the last 200 years as humans having done all kinds of silly things, to themselves and to the world as a reality. But now people are waking up, people are changing, are starting to realize the mistakes of the past 200 years. And there are X, Y, Z solutions on the table. And, you have to use the right language and try and make it relatable to the child's daily existence. So, you're not going to talk about fossil fuels per se, but you're going to talk about when daddy puts petrol in the car, now daddy can do something different. Now daddy can all go on the bus maybe once or twice a week. Or if there's no bus, you know what I'm saying? There's examples, right? But there's a way of speaking to children. But it is difficult, especially with younger ones. And I like to stay within the age range a little older because of the heavy technical content that is actually in my books, because there's so much research in there. I have to stay a little older age group, 9 to 12 years old, I think.
9 to 12.
Yeah, that's my ideal target age, range. These are kids who are already familiar with certain technical terms. They're looking at these subjects at school, and it kind of complements. But I'm interested in your earlier question about where does Captain Polo go?
Yes.
Yeah. And that is an important question, because that is actually the fundamental building block of foundation of my books. It is about geography. I could almost say it's a book about geography as much as it is about climate change, because the settings are very important. And they are based on personal experience, if not on some good research, which includes talking to subject matter experts. It includes talking to people from those countries to understand how society works in those countries. And I like to represent as accurately as possible the cultural idiosyncrasies of those locations. And that allows me to use humor, of course, and it all gets very, very interesting. So I'd like to say that a lot of my books use non-Latin languages in the texts, whether that's in the dialogues or whether that's in the background imagery, like on signposts and things like that. I often use, according to the country, the actual language of that country. Because of Google Translate, you can literally type a word or two in and it will spit out not only the meaning of it, but its actual alphabet. I can get Mandarin characters from Google Translate. I can get Arabic characters from, so I put those in. This is a little trade secret of mine. I literally copy paste the Arabic and put it into my drawings in my book, if that is relevant to the location. And I can even choose what country. Book 3, Captain Polo passes through Egypt, and there's some Arabic in there, and the Arabic is not generic Arabic, it's Egyptian Arabic. But no one's going to know that unless they are an Egyptian.
Right.
For me, that's important. It's that level of detail.
Representing.
The accuracy. And I think that's very, very important. But, I do base my books on the geography. Where will Captain Polo go? I have a basic idea in my head. I do some research on particularly pressing climate issues in certain parts of the world, and I make the story happen in those parts of the world. And then I do my research and on those parts of the world.
Awesome.
So,
your recent trip to a glacier in Ecuador.
Yes.
You said it sent you 5,000 meters above sea level.
Yep.
What did you take from that trip that you could share with us?
I took the silence and the beauty of nature. When you're up there at 5,000 meters, it looks like everything's just perfect. At least what I saw. Although I do know that the glacier today is a lot higher than it was 20 years ago. But basically, the glacier is shrinking. It's shrinking up the mountain.
They still mine the ice there?
You're right. That is in the volcano called Chimborazo. But that's not where I was.
Okay.
That one is closed for now for some reason. But you're right, they do mining, and I'm not sure whether they still do it. I don't think so. I think it's just a tourist thing now.
Okay.
But basically, generally speaking, and this goes for anywhere in the world, glaciers are shrinking. That's one of the tough realities. That's one of the tough realities. And there's not a damn thing we can do about it. Because
that's nature taking its course right there.
It's a tipping point that has been passed. We can't avoid it anymore, even if we just all drop dead today. That's just going to carry on going, and that's just the bad news of it. But you know, it's so what I took away from that trip was how lucky I was to still be able to see the glacier and to feel it with my fingers and feel the harmony. If you just stop talking for a minute with everybody, there's just the wind howling, and that's the only sound you have. And that silence, well, it's very inspiring. It makes you come down the mountain and want to double your efforts to save the world, basically.
You provide learning experience for kids through comics.
Yeah.
To give them a sense, to ease them into something new. How do you ease yourself into something new when you are about to, I don't know, step out into
a
new venture?
That's a tough question. I guess get inspired as I, most of the humor is in the combination between the text and illustrations. I have to say that I'm inspired. I've always been inspired since a little kid by Asterix comics and Tintin comics, which to today's generation may not be known, especially outside of France and Belgium, where those countries are the originators. But, you know, Asterix comics are pretty legendary across the world, at least for my generation. And it was a wonderful combination of wit, you know, wit based on situational comedy, a large amount of stereotype, I have to say. But, you know, stereotype, if it's well managed, can be very, very humorous. And so I draw on those things. And I like to play around with my characters. You know, Captain Polo is a multi-layered character who, on the surface, is a wild animal, but who happens to be talented at human things, like using cash and sailing and talking. And I can play around. That's the beauty of using fiction. You can play around like plasticine with reality.
Right.
And I'm very inspired by the, you know, the Looney Tunes characters that are crazy, like Bugs Bunny and Coyote. And, you know, Wile E. Coyote and the, you know, all those characters who are like suspended disbelief. They you know, they pull out a gun from behind their back, or they get a cannon from nowhere. And that kind of thing is, I like to play with that.
Yeah, that's what inspires your work.
It's just pure fun. It's just pure fun. It's that's what inspires
spontaneity.
The creative part of my work. What inspires the non-fiction part is the need to get the word out there and my personal commitment, lifelong commitment, with nature conservation. You know, it's that the combination of that commitment with having a good laugh is what inspires my books. To put it in a short nutshell. Yeah.
How can we mitigate some of the damages that have already occurred?
Well, that is a big question. And I happen to have in front of me, because I could talk about that with my own limited knowledge, but I prefer to draw upon a resource which I recently found, which is by an organization called Project Drawdown. Project Drawdown is a science-based institution that is growing and that is all about climate solutions. And here I have before me a table that is called the top 20 high impact climate actions for households and individuals. Okay, and there are four categories: our food, our waste, our travel, and our energy.
Food, waste, travel, and energy.
Yeah, those are the four pillars of individual action and also household action. And according to the science, the most powerful impact one can have is with the food, our food,
mm-hmm.
reduce our food waste, and adopt in our diet more plants. So plant-rich, it doesn't mean go vegan specifically. It means just balancing out things so that you're using more plants than meat in your diet.
To help that, reduce the carbon emissions that produce
that is produced from animal production. Mm-hmm. Because animal production is responsible for a huge amount, something like 30%, a huge amount of carbon emission or global, greenhouse gas emissions.
Greenhouse gases, it's incredible.
So those two, things about our food, reduce the food waste, and two, switch to a plant-rich diet. Because, of course, the food waste, the problem with that is you waste all the food that has been produced has taken up so much energy doing so. It has produced so much greenhouse gases being produced, and then it's not even used. That is a complete and utter waste of everything, not only of the food itself, but also of all the energy produced to make it. And so those are the four pillars without going into too much detail.
But
I recommend Project Drawdown as a resource. You just have to Google it. They have free resources, including very, very clear infographics. And, they really go to what you can do as an individual. And it's a very good resource.
Perfect. Speaking of food, which of these delicacies do you think deserve more shine?
Oh.
Biryani from Pakistan.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Italian pasta from obvious Italy. Italy. And the ceviche in Ecuador.
Well, I do love pasta, but that's certainly very popular and it doesn't deserve more promotion. I would say it's a difficult one because I do live in Ecuador.
Oh, you know what? So the question is, which delicacy do you think deserves more shine? Ceviche or something else from Ecuador?
I think actually an Ecuadorian dish, which is called locro.
Locro.
Locro de papa. And locro de papa is a traditional soup that is made of potato with avocado. And it's very rich and pretty delicious. You prepare it, you put coriander into it, and it's completely plant-based. And so, let's not forget there are several thousand varieties of potato, not just the potato you buy in the supermarket.
Several thousand, you say?
Several thousand varieties. Wow. According to what I've been told.
Wow.
It sounds like a lot to me, but that's what...
Yes, it does. I'd never heard that much.
Yeah.
Variety
before. You'd be surprised. Wow. But whether it's several thousand or several hundred, it's a lot more than what people usually use.
Right.
And Ecuador is one of the epicenters, and the Andes is one of the epicenters of potato, of wild potatoes. And... Mm-hmm. So I would put some shine on a very little known Ecuadorian dish called locro de papa, which is basically potato soup.
I'm looking that up and I'm gonna try to prepare that meal because it sounds yummy. Anything with avocado for me is good to go.
And you guys in Jamaica, you've got the best hot sauce. You know, so you throw some hot sauce in there and it would be delicious.
It would be delicious.
Delicious.
Give us a Spanish phrase that we could use in our everyday life.
A Spanish phrase. Oh, goodness.
Perhaps you can look at it from a climate change perspective. Yeah. And how to go about.
Yeah. I would say, cuídense para cuidar el planeta, which means take care of yourselves to take care of the planet.
Brilliant.
That goes back to what you said earlier about all being related, about caring for each other is the same as caring for the environment. You kind of made the point that I like to make, and I'm so glad you did because it's so important to say that. We mustn't silo things out. It's all the same thing. If you care for your neighbor, you're going to care for the plants and the animals. Of course, it's all related. So, cuídense para cuidar el planeta.
Perfecto.
There you go.
How can people reach you? How can they get access to your work?
Yeah, well, my books are all on Amazon. They're increasingly in other bookstores as well by order. They're not. I haven't got to the point where they're in actual brick and mortar stores on the shelves, because it's very hard to do that as an unknown, as a relatively unknown author. It's very difficult to get into bookshops physically, but they are on the lists, on the email, on the web pages of Blackwell's, of Waterstones, put those in UK, and major bookshops. But I think the best thing to do is reach me via my website, where you have the opportunity to look at the trailers of the books, to look at some free resources that I offer for climate education for kids and adults. Lots of free stuff to download. You can get book one of my series for free as an ebook to start you off, you know. And Polo himself has a page on my website where he's the one who runs it. He types his own blogs, signs with his paw, and he writes his own posts. There's videos.
Go to Polo. Giving you a Jamaican phrase. Go to Polo.
Go to Polo. There you go.
Got it.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Okay, cool. I like that. All right. Go to Polo. Yeah.
Go to Captain Polo.
Yeah. And so the website address is basically alanhesse.com, alanhesse.com.
Okay. Is there anything else, Alan, that you would like to share with the audience? Anything else that you would want us to take away from this program?
Yeah, I like to end these moments with a message. And the message is stay positive and try to leverage either what you're good at, what you're passionate about, what you do for a higher purpose. Try to leverage what you do or what you love, or if it's a hobby, or, you know, try and leverage what gets you up in the morning. What is your passion? Try and direct it towards a higher purpose. It doesn't have to be to do with climate change. It can be to help, you know, an orphanage down the road, or it can be to help with an old people's home, or it can be to help clear the drainage of a slum, or whatever it is, but make it count, because I think that's ultimately the only thing we can do, really, is to level. We can't do it all. We have to choose what we're good at or love or passionate about and make it count.
Certainly agree. Change starts with self. In the words of Alan Hesse, our guest this afternoon, do something that counts. Make a change, make a difference in not just your own life, but in someone else's. What does it mean to be environmentally conscious? I hope that we are all a bit smarter about it after listening to this episode. Thanks to you, our listeners, and our guest, Alan Hesse, for making this podcast possible. Cuídense para cuidar el planeta. We'll be right back.